My pleasure to introduce R.J. Sonny Taylor. I met Sonny a number of years ago at a lectureship. And he was selling songs, and we spent a good deal of time at lectureships visiting. I have an interest in the history of songs, and so we've talked a great deal about it, and we've become good acquaintances. We're not close friends, but we are acquaintances. He began lead singing at the age of 10. And served several congregations as song leader, and presently is the new minister of music at Woodland Oaks Church. He also speaks in seminars, song leading and worship seminars, as well as this what he has today, the Grassroots Hymnology. He's running Taylor Publications that continues to grow, and he is. He and his wife have studied the history of hymns just in America, I guess, or so, and then traveled over 350,000 miles in their research. He has a book called A Song Is Born, which I suppose you have some at your display, don't you? It's an excellent book, by the way. He deals with some songs that are, and the authors that we are not very well, probably not acquainted with. And so, Sonny, we're happy to have you. Thank you for coming.
It's a pleasure to be here with you and to share with you the passion that I have in hymns, hymnology, and the use of hymns in our churches. It's a study that I have really grown quite passionate about. Grassroots hymnology is the study of hymns, the text, the meaning, the application of the hymns. It's the study of the source of the hymns, the people and the circumstances in which they were written, and in which they come to life. It's also the study of a congregation's needs, the culture, the age, and trends. And then it's the grassroots, what I call the field research, which I call the hands-on type thing. It is extremely gratifying to be able to travel around and walk the areas where these people were, where they lived, and try to get a sense not only of the person, of the people, of the place, but the time and culture in which they lived and they wrote the hymns. Now, some have suggested that maybe it's a little vain to put the picture of yourself up there, but I'd call that vain if I wanted to put it. But you know, I've noticed if you read the obituaries, how many times you'll see an 80-year-old person with a 20-year-old picture. That does happen. Before I get into a little bit of the presentation about restoration writers, most of my search has been in America, but this past year I took a search trip, a hymnology tour to England with Dr. Jerry Rushford from Pepperdine University. It was a great experience. And all of you, I just want to cover this one brief comment here about John Newton. Many of you know the story of John Newton, how his mother died when he was six and he lived a tremulous life. And he was a captain of a slave ship and all the things that went on in his life, and then he turned it away and decided to follow Christ. Well, you know, it wasn't an easy turn. You know, it's just not like flipping a switch. It took him 10 years of study and work in order to be able to do that. And in my research and all the books that I have, and I have a lot of books, it has, you know, this is the only picture I had of Old England, but this year I had the opportunity to go to Old England and to see the steeple of the church there, and to see the town itself, and to see the only parish church, which was built in 1325, in which John Newton preached his first sermon. You know, John Newton, with his background, was not allowed to preach in the prestigious churches of London, but Old England invited him to speak, and he spoke there for about 15 to 17 years, and he was, you know, greatly loved at that congregation. But what is interesting, I think, is that the house in which John Newton lived is still there. And it's a private residence. They call it a vicarage. We call it a parsonage. But it was the house where the minister lived. And this is the house where John Newton wrote Amazing Grace. This is the very house that it was first written in. Let me get this here. Okay. As I said, it's a private residence. It belongs to John and Mary Wallace. That's Dr. Jerry Rushford on your left that conducted the tour. When we were on our way to England, and actually in the bus on the way to the house, we got a call that she had just learned that she had cancer, and that nobody was allowed into the house except Dr. Rushford and his group. So we were very fortunate to go into the house, up to the third floor study that John Newton used, looking out the window that he often looked out into his garden. And I want you to picture yourself today, if you were sitting in that environment, thinking about your life, the life that you were saved by grace from, through your salvation in Jesus Christ, what would you write? And this is what he wrote. Let's sing it. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found, was blind, but now I see. This is his third fourth study. And this is where he sat as he wrote Amazing Grace. And I think if you look at those words, it's kind of paradoxical in it that grace taught him to fear, but on the other hand, grace relieved his fears. It's a beautiful song that all of us, I think, have known. It is interesting if you study hymnology. While this thing was written, was first published in 1779, probably written a year or two earlier. And I will tell you this before I pass that. It was not sung in that church for the first time. It wasn't allowed to be sung in the church. Hymns were not allowed in the official churches of England, only the psalmistry. So he had to introduce it in a life group in his house. And that's where all of his songs were introduced, in his home, in this home that we're standing in right here. And then he wrote that song. I think it was a marvelous experience for me, and it's something that signifies, I think, what grassroots hymnology is all about, to kind of experience what happens there. Let me talk a little bit about restoration writers. I'm not going to have time to go back to a database that I've created, and one time I hope that we can just present that. But this database has a record of over 30,000 hymns. It has a record of about 1,300 songwriters. It has all of the major hymnals in there, and I'm constantly adding to it. This database started about 20 years ago, and I have just recently upgraded to the FileMaker Pro, which is cross-platform type database, and hopefully one day I'll get it onto the internet where you can search the background. It'll have the history of what I'm doing, it'll have the writers and all of that. But out of this base so far, I have discovered approximately 240 hymn writers that we have knowledge of that have been what we'd call part of the Restoration Movement. Now, about 30 or 40 of those are going to be what we'd call the Christian Church side, and the others probably in the Church of Christ side, but some of them varied and changed as they went through the years. But I've been able to document at least that many, and I wish I had time to talk about each one of them, because I've looked at the lives of many, 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 at least 1,000 hymn writers that have been within our hymnal. Few of our hymn writers in the Restoration Movement have had an impact upon our history outside of the church. Now, within the church, they've had a tremendous impact, and we all know those, and we could go down from L.O. Sanderson to Teddy Tedley, and all of the others have a tremendous impact, and I'll show you a little bit about that in a minute. But I never will forget, about 15 years ago, I was starting some of this research, and I was up in Lincoln, Illinois, at Lincoln Christian Seminary, working with Ennis Dowling, professor there, and this young man come in doing a dissertation, and he made this comment, "Few have had impact outside of the Restoration." I become very angry, because I thought our hymns were well-liked. But the more you study it, you realize that they have not gone much beyond the sphere of our Restoration Movement. With the exception, in the 19th century, people like Noel Shaw, the Fillmore brothers, had their impact upon other denominations, or denominations within the United States mostly. And I'll talk a little bit about that. But by and large, none of the hymnals that we have outside of our hymnals have any of the songwriters. There are a few exceptions. There are a few exceptions. Albert Brumley, for instance. "I'll Fly Away" is going to be in a lot of different hymnals. Albert Brumley was a member of the church. He married an elder's daughter, was a very strong member in Powell, Missouri, and he told the line. He made sure that he went to church all the time. His family was brought up in the church. Only one that I know of still remains a member, and that's Albert Jr. Bob Brumley. Albert Jr. went off a different direction. But Bob Brumley was still serving there in Powell, Missouri the last time I heard. You have others. I've seen one of Tedley's hymn in a Mennonite hymnal. Jesse Brown Pounds, which was in the Christian Church side. Some of her hymns were in the Baptist hymnal. Noel Shaw and the Fillmore brothers, as I've mentioned, in the 19th century, their hymns were quite popular, Bringing in the Sheaves, I Am the Vine, in other hymnals. As you come to contemporary music, the only ones that really have had an impact, but their church affiliation may not even be known that much, one is Rich Mullins. Our God is an Awesome God. Rich Mullins was a member of the Christian Church, and at the time of his death, a faithful member of the church, even though he was studying some other religions. But he was was buried. His funeral was at the Christian Church. Marty Nystrom, who wrote As a Deer Pants for Water, still has some affiliation with the Christian Church. And, of course, we all know about Amy Grant, who was brought up in the church, but pretty much has left any ties with the church. So we really, there's another one called Harold Lane. Anybody know Harold Lane? Harold Lane sung with the Spear family for 20 years. He wrote a few songs. None of them in our hymnal, but Harold is still a faithful member of the church there in Nashville. It has been my feeling that the hymnal editors or publishers have had the most impact on the songs that we sing. You know, you've got great songs of the church, 1921, and then you got Choice Gospel, and I won't mention all of these, but you go right down the line, and this is not an all-inclusive list, but this list is going to be those that have greatly influenced our brotherhood in the 20th century. Now, as we enter the 21st century, Brother Jeff Coat has put out a book that will be added to the bottom of the list, but I'm just talking about the 20th century. And those that are, if you can read them, bold italics are the only ones that are still in print. Sacred Selections, believe it or not, are still in print with Ellis Crum up in Indiana. Now, you have to understand that most of our churches at the turn of the 20th century were using little bitty books, something like this. And we had them by dime a dozen. You know, you'd pick them up in the back, depending on which one they wanted to use that Sunday. Will W. Slater had an awful lot of those different books. And many other writers had them. But as we got into 21 to 1950, we started migrating toward a all-in-one hymnal. And that's why you see the listing of just the major hymnals. And you know, Ello Sanderson's Christian Hymns 1, 2, and 3 had a great impact upon our brotherhood. Majestic Hymnal by the Firm Foundation had some impact, especially over in the Texas side. Hymns of Praise by Rule Lemons and Tedley This Tedley was a disaster. It never went anywhere. I put it on this list because it's a nice, nice hymnal, but it really never got off the ground. Neither did Great Songs of the Church Revised. Anybody remember the Great Songs of the Church Revised? Anyhow, my point of this is that most of the songs that we are influenced by are influenced by those editors who published the hymnals. Now, you look at Elton Howard's book, and how many of his own songs? He's got 30 or 40 of his own songs in there, right? So that's how we are influenced by the writers as we move into the all-in-one hymnals. Ello Sanderson had a significant number of his songs, not that many, but he had a significant number of his songs in each book. And then, you go right on down the line. This is a chart that I put together to give you some idea of the influence of what I call era. Classic songs were written prior to 1707. You've got European influence like Watson, Wesley, and all of those from 1707 to 1890. There's little influence, early influence, before you get into the convention music, Lowell Mason and some of those guys, but you have very little there. The gospel song has been the major influence, as you can look at it across there. And this, basically, we call it the gospel song from the Fanny Crosby. 1875 was the first hymnal that was published that had gospel song in it. But there were gospel songs being written prior to that. And Noel Shaw is a great example, and that's the one I'm going to end with today, is the discussion of Noel Shaw. But he had a great influence upon the gospel song era. Then you have the convention song, we call it the Stamps Baxter music, even though it had Vaughn Music and all of the other companies that put them out. And then you have what we call contemporary. Now, you look at the flow of these songs and how many were European in the Great Songs of Church number 2 revised. That was a great influence on our brotherhood and the colleges back in the 50s, 60s, okay, and the 70s. 70s is when the revised edition with a supplement came out. That's when you collected more gospel songs. So, but you see how many they had in the European-style songs before 1890. You look at Great Songs Revised over here, and look what they did. They went way up again in that type of song. This gives you an indication of why that hymnal never made it. It went backwards in the trends of times to the type of songs. It did not go forward. It had 1, maybe 2% of contemporary-type songs, and contemporary of that was anything from 1950 up. Surely not Awesome God or any of the stuff that we call contemporary today. But I'm talking about Because He Lived, which was contemporary 20 years ago. All right, but none of those were in that book. And so you can see, you begin to see if you take this chart and to see what happened. Now look at Songs of Faith and Praise, which is currently one of the bigger sellers that we have out there. And it has changed drastically into about 33% written after 1950. Have a tremendous amount of, there's over 220 contemporary songs, what we call praise and worship type. Some of you don't like, but I'm saying this is the nature of what's happening to hymnals as we go along. Now, at another time, I'll give you a concept of what trends are happening, but this is not that class, okay? So I don't have time for that. But anyhow, you can see how the books have varied through those charts. Now, I will have some of these up here as handouts. And if I didn't know how many would bring, so if we run out, just put your email, your name and phone number, and I'll email you these presentations if you want that. There's another chart I wanted to show you, and that is taking a look at the religious affiliation of the people who wrote our songs that are in our hymnal. Now, I have two categories here. One is Church of Christ, that means acapella side, and one is all of the Restoration, which includes the Christian Church as well. And as you can see, within our brotherhood, there's a significant influence, but it begins to taper off as you get out into your Songs of Faith and Praise. Now, where it's going from here, I don't know, but we'll be glad to talk about it sometime. But this just gives you a concept. Actually, the Methodists are probably the more solid group throughout the history of our hymnetry that have been included. You go all the way back to the Gospel Advocate version, who hired a Methodist editor to help them with their first hymnal, and that gives you the influence that we have. And the other thing about the Methodists, they had these campgrounds scattered all over the United States. They had Ocean Grove, they had Pittman Creek, and I've been fortunate to visit both of those this past year. They have Lake Chappaquiddy up in New York. These were not just campgrounds. These were summer-long events where these people wrote music and did a lot of study. Okay, but that just gives you a concept of where the songs come from. That were in our book. Now, the editors of the hymnals, I said earlier, I think are the ones that have influenced us the most about the songs that we sing. And I start with Noel Shaw, because Noel Shaw, in 1860s to 1870s, his style of songs, from Bringing in the Sheaves to I Am the Vine, he wrote about a little over 100, between 100 and 117 songs, are the ones that begin to have an influence upon us, as well as religious society, because these songs were also sung. Then you have the Fillmore brothers. You got Charles Fillmore, you got Fred Fillmore, A.D. Fillmore was the dad, who published books out in Cincinnati, Ohio. Then F.L. Island, and then you come on down to Jorgensen, which is Great Songs of the Church, Slater, and on down the list to R.J. Stevens. And again, this is 20th century, so I haven't picked up Jeff Coates' book into the 21st century yet. But this is a listing of all of those. Now, you've had other writers that have some influence, but basically their songs have appeared in one of these books. You got Robert S. Arnold, the song we sung to start with. Robert S. Arnold was a great member of the church, lived to be 98 years old. He was a cattleman. He lived in Coleman, Texas. And I was fortunate to have a great relationship with Arnold up until his last few months, few weeks. But... And you have others. You have Holland Boer, and you have M. Linwood Smith, from the ultra-conservative side, the One Cup side of the Brotherhood, who publishes books every year. But their influence is pretty much limited, except maybe one song here and there. But really, what I want to focus on the rest of this period, and then if you got any questions, we'll get into it, is what I think really started us on our trend, and that is Noel Shaw and the type of songs that Noel Shaw wrote. I Am the Vine is one of the last he wrote a year before his untimely death, and I think it winds up serving as his autobiography. I Am the Vine, and You Are the Branches. I think in the decade from 1860 to 1870, he probably held more successful gospel meetings than any man in the Restoration Movement. And you think about that, and we'll talk about his life a little bit. But the study actually begins, he was born in Rushville, Indiana, just below Indianapolis. But his family home was in Milford, just below Rushford, that he grew up in to start with. But then I want to start my search of Mr. Shaw, over in Moscow, Indiana. Now, I'm not going to do as a detailed study. I have a detailed study of Noel Shaw. And in fact, I have here, if you're interested in an email, I have a 7-chapter presentation on Noel Shaw that you can put one chapter a week in your bulletin. And it's written in such a way that they'll be looking for the next chapter. And I'll be glad to email that to you if you want it. But this is about Noel Shaw and his life. I didn't write it. It was written by a writer in 1967. But he did a great job. I did add an appendix to it. But I want to start in Moscow, Indiana. And what I do in grassroots hymnology, is I say, okay, I'm going to go to Moscow, Indiana. I want to see what the town looks like. So Barb and I drove to Moscow, Indiana. And there we found the Christian Church, as it's called today. And this is where Noel Shaw lived at the time that his father was ailing. And in fact, his father and mother were members of that Christian Church. Now, when I drove into town probably, I would estimate, had 25 people, maybe 30. You know, it wasn't very big. Just one little strip in the church and the cemetery, and that was about it. So what I look for, usually when I go into town, is either a library, or I'll walk the cemetery, or I'll look for the oldest person in town, or I'll try to do anything like that to try to get a conversation. Well, when I drove into town, there was a gentleman, he wasn't that old, walk out of his house and was out in his yard. He made that mistake, because I stopped and started talking to him. And, you know, I struck up a conversation. I says, do you know anything about Noel Shaw? He said, who? No, he didn't know anything about it. This was 150 years ago. He wasn't aware of Noel Shaw. But we had a great conversation because he owned this grist mill, which is on the Flat Rock River. Basically, what I was looking for was the Flat Rock River Church, Christian Church. That's where Noel Shaw had his beginning. And I couldn't find it. So I said, do you know where that's at? He said, yeah, I know where it's at. But let me show you my grist mill. So I want to show you what I do in this grist mill. And he does some woodwork. So he goes in his grist mill. And he says, you're talking about music. So I built my own instrument. I call it a musican. So he got a sawhorse and saw blades and a little wire there that he plucked on. And he created his own little instrument there in that sawmill. He had to show me that with his friendly cat walking around, you know, listening to his music. But this is some of the great experiences that I've been able to have in grassroots hymnology. Just to listen to people in their environment, you can get a sense of what's going on. He showed me the building just across the street there from him. He said, that's where the Barlow knife was first invented. That's his word. I don't know. Okay, so you'll have to take it as a grain coming from an individual who's proud of his little town. But he said that's where the Barlow knife, where the blacksmith shop, was first invented. Noel Shaw was born October the 13th, 1834. And his father died before he was 13 years old, just shortly before he was 13. And he made Noel Shaw promise two things to him. He said, I want you to prepare to meet God, and I want you to take care of your mother. And he also gave him a violin that he had. Well, Noel did not know how to play the violin. But he was impressed with those two things that his father promised him. Prepare to meet God and take care of your mother. Now, Albion Shaw died there in Moscow, Indiana, and is buried there in the cemetery. And Noel was the oldest of three children, and he had to go to work to help support the family, to take care of the mother, okay? And here he was, 13 years old. So he was working night and day in the farm. He was doing anything he could to try to do that. And then he discovered this little fiddle that his dad gave him. And some say that his stepfather, his mother remarried, helped him learn to play the fiddle. But as I look at Noah's life, he learned on his own. He was very talented. So he began to play this fiddle, much to the chagrin of his brother and his sister. They didn't like it, because every evening after the chores were done, he'd get on that fiddle, and they were very unhappy. But he learned to play it very well. And then he began to play this thing. He was invited to play it at the community dances. And he was quite good at it. And he not only could play the fiddle, he could sing. And he was very, very talented. His popularity grew. And he didn't know it, but he was making money. Because after he'd play it, they'd come together and said, here's your love offering that they gave you. And he said, what's that? I'll play for the fun of it. He said, no, you got to take this. And so he'd go out the morning, he could make it a week. And so he really got involved in it. But the real problem that developed in this environment was the whiskey. And it was free-flowing at these events. And the whiskey really began to play a part in his life. And he really got addicted to it. He really began to drink, just like everybody else at the dance. He was really bothered with this. At the height of his popularity, they say there were at least 40 people at the dance. He was taking care of his mother, but the second promise wasn't working for him, prepare to meet God. And he just felt like that he was not in the right environment to make that happen. He just felt like he wasn't really handling that. So at the middle in the intercession, in between the dances, he put his fiddle away and he stepped to the center of the crowd and he said, look, you all know me, but he said, I am committed to believe that what I'm not in the right environment in order to be able to meet my God. And he said, I don't want any of you to interfere with me because I've made this decision and it's been weighing heavy on my mind. And he laid his fiddle down and he quit drinking alcohol and he never, ever went back. He never went back. This is a young man that's 17 years old. 17 years old. And he made this commitment. I did find the Flat Rock Christian Church. It was over by this covered bridge. I will say that when the Shaw family, when she remarried, they lived across the street from the Flat Rock Church. But there were three things impressed me about Noel Shaw. And I think that's the three things that I wanted to talk about today. First of all, his conversion. Secondly, his preaching ability. And thirdly, his effective use of music. Noel had attended church occasionally through up till he was 17, from 13 to 17, but really never had an interest in it. But when he stopped drinking now, he began to think about, well, I want to go hear what these people say. So he'd go over to the church, and he'd listen, but he really never was that much involved in it. But it began to be more interesting when he had quit playing the fiddle at the dances and drinking. And he began to study. And finally, after hearing an appealing sermon by Gabriel McDuff, Knowles made his confession on September 13th, 1852, just before he was 18 years old. He was baptized with George Thomas, an elder of the church. The preacher took a special interest in Knowles. And people said, oh, he's too far gone. He's been involved in all his riotous life. But he took a special interest. And he stayed with him. But there's a couple of things that really impressed me. This is the Mud Creek where Knowles was baptized. You talk about getting intense in your search. I wanted to find out where he was baptized. And it's documented to the little pond to where Noel Shaw was baptized. And at age of 17, in this modest little pond, this young man made a confession to the Lord. I love you, Lord. I repent of my sins. I believe in Christ. I want to be baptized, and I will serve you. Now, that's a pretty strong confession for a young man. And we make that. We see our teens make that, but this teen really meant it. And he committed every day of his life to that confession. This is the Flat Rock Christian Church, and he began to attend this church. Noel Shaw had no intention of being a preacher. It was a furthest from his mind. He felt very strongly that he wasn't educated enough to be a preacher. He really wanted to be educated, but he didn't have the funds or the means to be able to do that. He could learn extremely well. From the age of 17 to the age of 24, he began to work at any odd job. He learned how to repair shoes. He learned how to repair clocks. He learned how to repair sewing machines. And he could do that for a living. And he could do all of these things as well as work on the farm. And he went to church regularly and consistently, but he never really had any intention of being a preacher. And then one day, it happened. The preacher didn't show up. And the preacher didn't show up, and the elder says, "Well, Knowles, why don't you get up?" He said, "Oh, no, I'm not a preacher. I don't have the eloquence." He said, "Yeah, but you've studied the Word. You know, we want to hear what you have to say." He stumbled through that talk, and you know, many of them said, "Well, we like what you heard," but on the other hand, he was not impressed. He said, "I'll never make a preacher." But it really worked on him. It really worked on him because he said, "I can do better. I can do better." And he began to study, and he began to work. In 1924, he was ordained to preach at that Milroy church. I think his preaching style is the other thing that really interests me. His style was considered eccentric. The only theology that Knowles had learned was at the feet of great preachers and his constant study of the Bible. He hadn't studied it in any seminary or anything. He was never a conventional preacher, as we would talk about it, either in dress, mannerism, our habits, our conversation, for that matter. He just wasn't like anyone else. He was, G.H. Hoover once said of him, "He imitated no one but the Christ in whom we profoundly believed and whom he sought faithfully to devotedly to serve." His entire ministry was devoted or dominated by love. And if you think of the song, "I Am the Vine, You Are the Branches," in the second verse will have a reference to the love that he really believed in. He loved the church, he loved people, and he loved music, but he would go into these places that he wanted to preach, and he would meet the people where they were. He wouldn't wait for them to come. He would go to their home, to their barn, the house, wherever they lived, and if they had a problem, if they needed something repaired, he'd repair it for them. He wouldn't charge them, he said repair it. But they're always talking about Christ. Always talking about Christ. So he met the people where they were, and after he showed them he cared, then he taught them about Christ. I think the music side of this is extremely interesting. Someone said in a Memphis press, "Though we have heard finer vocalists, we scarcely have met a man who could so successfully sing his sentiments into the souls of people." He would sing his sentiments into the souls of people. He was obsessed because he decided that 30 minutes before he would begin to preach, he would have singing. 30 minutes before he began to preach, he'd start singing. That attracted the crowd and got them ready to receive his message. But also, during his sermon, if he decided that you were sleeping a little bit, he'd get out there and stand on that pew. He'd sing a song. You got your attention again. And he'd start over. And he'd start preaching again. He had a way with music that brought the people in. I want you to understand this, that in 1860s and 1870s, the music of the day was gospel music. That was what everybody heard and everybody sung. It wasn't rock music that you see. It wasn't the country music. It was religious music. Oh, you had a few folk songs that went along out there. But people's fascination with gospel music and songs is what they heard. Knowles Shaw was the rock star of the 1860s. And bringing in the sheaves was the mega hit. You think about that. Here was a young man that could not only preach, he could sing. And he could draw the crowds like a rock star. And he could get their attention with songs he wrote, like Bringing in the Sheaves. And then they would listen to his sermons that he would preach in love. At the Flat Rock Church, there's this monument on this rock there, and you can't read it. I could hardly read it, so I had to write it out for you. It said, "Preacher, author, singer, evangelist, converted and preached his first sermon at the big Flat Rock Christian Church. He brought 20,000 souls into the Church of Christ, prepared to meet thy God, Amos 4:12. Wrote and put to music 100 gospel songs, the best known, Bringing in the Sheaves, Handwriting on the Wall, Tarry With Me." He wrote the music for those, not the words. He did write the words for Bringing in the Sheaves. "Beautiful Dream, I Am the Vine, Music and Words, It Is Far, I Love Jesus, We Believe." The last words of him were, "It is a glorious thing to rally the people to the cause of Christ." The results were impressive. Knowles kept a record. His record said 11,400 souls converted. That monument said 20,000. I don't know, maybe, you know, normally the preacher's count is higher than the other count. But in this case, it didn't work. Knowles had a record of 11,400. He may have been talking about baptisms, where they may have been talking about restorations and everything involved in bringing people back. I don't know. But you look at it in a period of less than 20 years of a young man's life from the age of 24 to 48, He was able to preach more than 450 sermons per year, twice a day most of the time, as best he could, and travel around the country. He had a family life. He married and had five children. Three of those died before he did, and there were two still living when he passed away. But if you think about the words of his song, "Yes, by your fruits the world is to know you, walking in love as children of day," that's the nature of Noel Shaw. He walked in love. He was not harsh with the people, but he walked in love where they worked. He went to their homes where they lived. He worked with them side by side, and then he taught them about Christ. He was extremely effective with that. When he promised his earthly father, "I'll take care of mother, I'll prepare to be God," he did it. When he promised his heavenly father, "I love you and I will serve you," he meant it. When was the last time we thought about our commitment to God? Mm-hmm. Did you mean it? Mm-hmm. Did you really mean it? A few years back, I stood on the banks of the river near Wilson Creek, where Noel Shaw met his death. It was in a train wreck. On a train track from Dallas to McKinney, Texas. And I walked down this thing about a mile to get to the trestle where the train went off the trestle and into the swollen Wilson Creek. And there were 28 people injured on that train and only one death, and that one death was Noel Shaw. One death. You know, and I think about this and how tragic it is that here was a gospel preacher who was extremely effective, and yet he met his death. But then I think back, boy, did he touch a lot of lives? Did he touch a lot of lives? Did he leave a great example for all of us? I think so. He was living in Columbus, Mississippi, by the way. His family was living in Columbus, Mississippi at the time of his death. Even though he just preached a sermon, finished a sermon at the Christian church in Dallas, and one on his way. Now you understand, the Christian church, and they hadn't really divided names that distinctively at that time. So it was still part of the Restoration Movement until we get into the early 1900s that we've defined it. But he preached a sermon at the Christian church, and he was invited to McKinney. He hadn't planned on it. He was going to hold a three-week meeting at McKinney, Texas, and that's where he met his death. He's buried there in Rushville, Indiana. And the tall monument is his, and I think it's interesting that the reading on the monument says, "An acceptable evangelist of the Church of Christ." An acceptable evangelist of the Church of Christ. How true. Anyway, his last words were, it's a glorious thing. Somebody says that while he's on the train, he had stood up talking to another minister, not a member of the church, but I think it was a Methodist minister. And he was expounding how great and thrilled he was to understand about being able to preach the gospel. It's such a glorious thing to rally the people to cause of Christ. That was his last statement. Converted, as I said, 1,400, and wrote about 117 songs. I think his music was the important thing that kept it together. He had a clear understanding of the gospel. He knew the Bible. He loved personal contact. He was a tireless worker in the kingdom. He had an outstanding ability as a singer. And an intense passion to serve God. You take those ingredients and put them together, you've got a successful ministry. What about your commitment to make love? "All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Teach them to obey everything what I command you." I want to sing at least one verse of this, and then we'll bring it to an end. "I am the vine, and ye are the branches. Bear precious fruit for Jesus today. Branches in him no fruit ever bearing. Jesus has said he taketh away. I am the vine, and ye are the branches. I am the vine, be faithful and true. Ask what ye will, your prayer shall be granted. The Father loved me, so I have loved you."
Amen.
I want to thank you so much. I have much more. I could go into FL Island, which started the Trio Music Company, which was the next one on that list, and then the Fillmore Brothers. but my time is gone, and thank you so much. The presentations are here. I mean, the charts are here if you want those. This one I only have one copy of. That's the seven chapters, but just put your email and number down, and I'll email you those things if you want them. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Steiner, for that session. If you will, be assembling the panelists, all the friends, and Brother Don, if you could sit in with us, and Brother Sonny also, right up here. And we'll start in about 4 or 5 minutes.
We have some brochures if you'd like to.
Brother Taylor, did you know that Terry with me on my favorite was N.B. Hardeman's favorite song?
Oh, is that right?
Oh, okay.